Here's why you need to attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. Reason number one is networking. The opportunity to connect in person with like-minded recruitment business owners and share strategies and best practices. Of course, you can do that via Zoom or Teams, but the connection is deeper when you do it in real life. Wouldn't you agree? One of our previous attendees, Darcy, said that she loved the speakers and the content, but the best part for her was in between the sessions, the informal conversations with other successful business owners that sparked incredible insights and those aha moments. The quality of people in the room will be incredible, including many of the people you've heard me interview on this podcast. There's going to be big billing recruiters as well as business owners with multi-million pound businesses. What they all have in common is that they prioritize their own development. And no matter how successful they already are, they want to keep learning and growing. What's even more special and remarkable about this group is that they're all willing to share their knowledge and they're so generous at helping each other improve. Early bird pricing is still available. Register now by visiting recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby, and I'm very happy to be joined today by Mike Silverstein. Mike is the managing partner of DRI's Healthcare IT and Life Sciences practice. In 2014, Mike was inducted into the Pinnacle Society, which is, as many of you guys already know, the nation's premier consortium of top recruiters within the direct placement and search industry. In 2016, Mike was named as one of the most influential millennials by staffing industry analysts. And so listen, Mike founded the healthcare IT practice in 2008, big recession year, as you guys know. Under his leadership, the life sciences practice has expanded and grown significantly year over year. Additionally, in 2011, Mike helped found what is now DRI's hospital IT group as managing partner. And essentially, they're focused on hospital IT staffing and consulting with a focus on recruiting the executive level and C-suite through to individual contributor roles within healthcare software and services organizations nationwide. Mike is known as one of the top healthcare IT recruiters and life sciences recruiters in the United States. Mike, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you, Mark. Appreciate it very much.
So we met back in April in San Diego at the Pinnacle Society conference, and I knew a few people already who'd already been on the show, but I didn't. There's a lot of people I didn't know, including yourself. And I didn't know who you were, but I saw this guy. Most people were wearing like smart casual, sort of like chinos and button shirts. And I saw this guy wearing shorts and flip flops. And I was like, wow, you have to be a really confident person to pull that off. Like, it makes me think you're someone who isn't concerned with conforming to other people's expectations or worried about what other people think. Is that an accurate description?
It's pretty fair. In fact, this is pretty dressed up for me. I usually spend most of my day not on Zoom in a tank top and shorts. So yeah, this is buttoned up Mike today, Mark.
Excellent. Wow, you dressed up especially for me. That's hilarious. So I just got finished a few minutes ago recording an interview with Fernando Espinoza, another Pinnacle member. I love that guy. What a phenomenal human being he is. How well do you know him?
So Fernando, I know him really well. Fernando was the one that I think Fernando interviewed me when I for Pinnacle when I was trying to get in. And I was like, man, this dude is amazing. And Fernando, for a guy, I wear shorts and flip-flops. Fernando, I don't think I've ever seen him without a sport jacket on. So he's the best dressed cat. He is, you know, we got to work. He's been using the same, Pancho Lopez joke for like a decade now. So we got to work on that a little bit. But Fernando's my guy. He's awesome.
Did you know he's fluent in Japanese?
I think I knew that a little bit. I don't think I've ever heard him speak Japanese, but I know he does a ton of international stuff, and he's sneaky. He's like closet brilliant, and he tries to disarm you with the humor, but he's great.
Exactly, absolutely. He's a super humble guy, but what a great character. I also interviewed your colleague Norman Volsky recently, and he did an awesome job.
Have you heard that interview yet?
I listened to part of it. So now Norm's an experienced podcaster. He started his own podcast recently. So Norm's a hoot. Yep, I've known. I was the guy actually that hired Norm as an intern way back when he was driving a little Toyota Smart car with the mirror hanging off in college, and you know, talked him into coming back afterwards, and he's been phenomenal ever since.
I heard about that. He said that he had joined you were his first boss in recruiting. He joined you as an intern. What about yourself, Mike? How did you get into recruitment?
I got into recruitment by accident. Mm-hmm. I had this really grandiose career in commercial real estate planned. I had interned with a few big commercial real estate firms in college, and before my senior year in college, I interned for this company, and they offered me a job coming back after school, and I was really, really excited. And as a result, had a really casual senior year of college because I already had a job in hand. And lo and behold, you know, that was the fall of 2007, going into the spring of 2008, and you know, the company, I wasn't really paying too much attention outside of cheap beer in college and you know, running around, and you know, the company's stock price had dropped from like $55 a share to $5 a share while I was a senior in school. And so I came back, and this really, you know, high-flying, neat place, like people were a lot grouchier when I started in the summer of 2008. And so started in June, was out of a job by August. I got fired from that job. I wasn't laid off. It was I learned a lesson in that I went to a happy hour with some of the management trainees that I started with, and I had kind of learned like some of the people that went to the same university as the president of the company were like in these really high up positions, and they were starting to get invited to like poker games at the president's house over the weekend, and I'd hear about it Monday morning. And so apparently this is you know, potential hearsay because I don't remember saying this, but I said you had to kiss the president of the company's ass to get ahead of this company. And then Monday morning I got a really nasty email from the president of the company, 2 pages long, and Friday morning I didn't really think anything of it because I was 21 and you know, had no idea. But I had this meeting put on my calendar with HR on Friday morning, and by 8:30 Friday morning Mike was walking out with a box and going back to his parents' house to figure out what he was going to do with the rest of his life. So I got into recruiting after painting my parents' basement for 2 weeks, and my buddy's father, who good buddy from high school and college, who owned this little recruiting firm. I was like, oh, maybe he could help me find a job. And he offered me a job for half what I was making 2 weeks earlier. And I wasn't a great painter, and none of my other friends that graduated in 2008 had jobs. And so that's how I got into recruiting. I said, sign me up.
Amazing. It's so funny, these pivot points where at the time it probably felt like a disaster, but in retrospect,
the world was coming to an end. Yeah. The world was squarely coming to an end.
And yet, like, you're so much better off. Like, that sounds like I mean, maybe it was a good company, but culture-wise, that doesn't sound like it was a fit for you anyway. And you've done so well in recruiting. It was like such a huge opportunity in disguise.
It was the best thing that happened to me. And yeah, that company, shortly after that, the guy that was the president, he took over as CEO pretty shortly thereafter. And as you can imagine, he changed the dress to business professional, so a suit and tie every day for the next 5 years. And we've already discussed that probably wasn't going to be a great fit for me. So right. Yeah, no, this was it was a fortunate move, and you know, a blessing in disguise.
Right. Wow. So you got into recruiting at a difficult time, like during a recession, and you built a practice from scratch, an industry you didn't know. Tell me that story. How did you make that work?
Yeah, so Direct Recruiters had been in business since 1983, was probably an 8 or 9 person business, you know, successful business, but probably hadn't done more than $1 million, $1.2 million in the history of the company. But it was very, you know, focused on like manufacturing automation, which lo and behold was also dead in 2008. Yeah. So I was handed a printout of a database out of a database called WinSearch, which is I don't know if it still exists, but it was, I was given like 3,000 names and told, go cold call and find some business and make 80 calls a day. And that was my job. And so, after, you know, if I'd make 77 calls for some reason, Shell Meyerhoff, the president of the company, would pull me into his office the next day. And I'm like, what happened yesterday? And I'm like, I don't know, man. So, and literally I was calling companies and people were kind of chuckling at me. They're like, yeah, we're not hiring people. In fact, we're letting people go. So good luck, buddy. So that was, but I, you know, I kind of managed to find a few leads, and I was kind of good at, you know, making a game of it that I had to, you know, 40 calls before lunch, 40 calls after lunch. And it was my dad would meet me at the Subway, fast food restaurant, like a couple miles down the road every Wednesday, and would buy me a sandwich. And like that and a couple late after work conversations with some of the guys that worked at the company who are still here, kind of talking me off the ledge on the weekly, that's how I got started. And was fortunate, Shelley agreed to send me to this, healthcare IT trade show that I kind of discovered. It was at the McCormick Center in Chicago in the spring of 2009. And, he actually went with me to McCormick, and we just kissed babies and shook hands and got a bunch of business cards for a couple of days and brought those back, spread them out on the table, put them in a database, and started cold calling. And that was how I got into healthcare IT. So it was
amazing,
you know, so fortuitous.
Awesome. And so how did you choose, why did you choose healthcare IT? I mean, it was a good decision, right? That's been a huge growth industry, but at the time, what was your rationale?
I thought healthcare, I was hoping, would be somewhat recession insulated. Yeah. People get sick. This seems better than manufacturing, where they could just turn it off. So that was as simple as that. Was hoping that it was a better place to be than manufacturing.
All right, makes sense. And then, so it wasn't a huge big strategy. It was like, you know, manufacturing is dead. This seems like a better.
I'd like to say that I had consulted with, you know, BCG or McKinsey to figure that out. No, it was more out of survival.
Okay. So, awesome. So yeah. Then how did it go from there? Because like what we're looking back, so we're now 15 years later, and you've built a phenomenal practice, multiple recruiters, multi-million in annual production. Like, what were those key milestones along that journey, Mike?
The one lesson that I took away from the guy that fired me earlier in the summer, who I had actually had a really good relationship the previous summer. So the guy that fired me actually gave me a hug and hired me the summer before. Was his thing was, hey, everybody puts their pants on one leg at a time. And so the job that I had in the real estate industry was commercial real estate industry. I was helping to renew leases in commercial shopping centers. So my job was to call up people that were already tenants in a shopping center, and I had to get them to agree to like 5-year lease extensions with as big of a raise in their rent as I could. And so it turned out that, you know, I coming out of college, I had never done anything like that. I had worked at a paint store. I had always been in I came from a sales family. My parents are both in sales. But it turned out I was pretty good at somehow building rapport and relationship with people over the phone that I never met and getting them to sign new lease agreements to pay more money, right, to do the same thing they had. And so, it was really good experience getting really comfortable on the phone and you know, getting people to agree to things that, you know, were in their best interest to keep the spot they were in, but you know, getting them to fork up something. Right. And so, I was really good at it. I was actually the best producer in the leasing department for a couple summers. And so the experience of doing that really got me comfortable with just being on the phone. And at the time, really, I had nothing to lose. So I was calling and I'd always kind of been the kid that even when I was a kid, I loved talking to the adults. Right. And just having conversation and, I was always avid you know, reading the news, watching the news, you know, like current events, and was pretty good at kind of striking up conversation. And so it really, you know, what was interesting about 2009 and healthcare IT, even though the business was really business was better than manufacturing, it was still really poor. And so what actually worked in my favor is there was a ton of really experienced people that had actually been laid off in healthcare IT also. And so there was a ton of people that actually took the time to talk to me about, they would talk to me because they wanted to talk to me about their career and hoping I could help them. But they really took the time to really educate me on the space, which is a pretty complicated space. And so, you know, people were sitting at home with, you know, in their pajamas, and they'd explain to me, hey, here's what this company did, and here's how the industry works, and blah, 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 right? And so it was a tremendous learning experience. And I think it was serendipitous in the fact that I was 22. I didn't have anything else to do. But, you know, I've always loved people. I'm a social guy. And so I would just get people talking about their career, and I was genuinely interested, and I think they could tell I was genuinely interested. And so they took a liking to me. And so as those folks kind of slowly got back into kind of key roles in industry, a lot of them were, in influential positions. And so I was afforded the opportunity to, you know, I picked up a search and I'd go grind on that. And I always, you know, I took the focus of really calling high to try to, I was like, you know, if I'm going to do this, I might as well get to know really senior people, because why not, right? I made a placement and then would be able to parlay that into another opening or two. And the 80 call a day routine really kind of, you know, there was a volume element to it. In fact, I drove around in my car for the first few months on the job, listening to the Scott Love training CDs.
Oh yeah,
Scott. His whole bank account concept of putting deposits in the bank account before you make withdrawals, that was real. That made a whole lot of sense to me. I watched all the Jeff K foundational training videos, which is kind of crazy. I give him a hard time because now Jeff's my partner in our new company, but. Jeff had this, big bright blue shirt. So I listened to Jeff K in the lunchroom, and I listened to Scott before and after work. And between those two guys and some of the guys I work with in my office, just kind of came up with, a little bit of a shtick just tried to, my whole metric was, go make a couple friends every day. And friends would be, in my eyes, people that would accept my LinkedIn and would take a call with me at a later date. And I had kind of the beautiful mind thing going in my cubicle. Like I had all these post-it notes and stickers and, call this guy back in June and this, so it was just really down and dirty, just trying to make something happen. So that's kind of how I got into it. I love it.
Let me just break down a couple of things you said. So first of all, taking the time to speak to executives in transition, so many benefits of doing that. And I don't understand recruiters saying things like, people complain if they send an email campaign out, it's aimed at hiring authorities because they want job orders, right? And then someone replies back and said, hey, I'm actually interested in talking to you about, other opportunities. And they're disappointed about that. They're upset. Like, I'm getting candidates and not searches here. And to me, that's a missed opportunity because, those candidates are your clients of the future and they're responding to you. They're asking for help. What better opportunity? Yeah, you're not going to make any money now or maybe this quarter, but, what better opportunity to build relationships with those senior people and add some value? That's the emotional or the bank account thing you mentioned. So that was smart. Huge respect for that. You skimmed over something, though, that I didn't really catch. You said something about parlaying one placement into other searches and calling high to go low. Now, I think maybe Norm explained something similar, but could you go over that again, please?
Yeah, certainly. So look, I mean, I think, my approach was, I'm not going to get a second at bat with a company unless I really work my tail off on the first one. And I think, you know, people that were giving me the opportunity to work on a search, they were taking a gamble, right? I was a 22-year-old kid. You go on my LinkedIn, I couldn't hide it, right? Like I was, yeah. I was in real estate for 3 months, 2 months earlier. And so, the only thing that you know, I would tell folks, look, you know, give me a shot. Doesn't cost you anything up front, and I'll work my butt off, you know? And so I think work ethic and the focus on making a really great impression. And even when I didn't make the placement, of which I didn't make a lot, there was a lot, you know, early on. I mean, some of the companies that turned out to be great clients of mine, I didn't make the second, third, or fourth. You know, I worked on 4 or 5 positions before I made a placement.
Wow.
Right. And so I think the fact that folks saw that I was kind of I was dedicated, I was hustling, you know, even when they gave me bad news, I'd say, hey, I appreciate the opportunity. I tried to, like, you know, I tried not to burn any bridges. I tried to really, you know, show an appreciation, yeah, for taking the shot on me. Cause yeah, look, I wasn't Kay Bassman. I wasn't Danny Cahill. I wasn't, you know, Corn Ferry. I was, you know, Mike from Cleveland, that doesn't know anything. So the only thing I had in my favor was just working hard, which is just kind of what I learned from my upbringing. And so I think people took, you know, I gained some affection from folks by just, they could tell I was hustling. Yeah. And so they came back to me. And so they'd say, Mike, do you know how to, you know, we need a marketing person or a product manager. I was like, well, I don't know what that is, but if you'll take the time to explain it to me, I will go learn it and I'll go find it for you. And so that was really how I parlayed one into another. And, you know, from taking that and building relationships with a VP of sales, and that VP of sales, he or she would say, hey, you know, my buddy that I worked with at Cerner years ago, it runs sales at another company. I told him I met this kid that will work his tail off. You know, let me introduce you to him. And I'm like, hey, I appreciate that so much. And so I kind of made my way around in little circles of professional friends that took a shot on me. And I, you know, and that's kind of how I, you know, was able to kind of get some leverage on my efforts and always, you know, thank those folks, send them handwritten notes, took the time to send them little gifts and things like that. And, let them know that, you know, I appreciate everything that anybody was willing to do. And I think till this day, like, that's how I approach it. Like, I don't, I talk to kids, friends, spouses of hiring managers and people in industry all week long. And you know, the more you can kind of, especially when people are vulnerable or they could use, they need help. Like, there is, it is totally backwards if you're not spending the time with folks, because it's one thing, you know, when they've got money, you need money, and you're saying, hey, can I get some of your money? But the more you can, you know, genuinely take an interest in folks, they feel that. And I had another lady early on in my career, one of the first placements that I ever made, this woman named Kathy Willis, who I'll never forget. And Kathy told me, hey, you know, I could tell you're a hustling kid, but do yourself a favor, never sell on the first call. And so I learned that if you can resist the urge to sell on the first call, you're going to land in the friend or you know, consultant bucket versus the person that 5 minutes into a call is asking for something. And if you can resist the urge to call on the first call, you'll have carte blanche to ask for stuff for the rest of the relationship, because you've established yourself in the right part of somebody's brain.
That's wow. That's cool. I like that. Kathy Willis. That's a great tip. So just rewind on a couple of things. I think your authenticity definitely comes across, Mike. The fact that you were so genuine and sincere. People have to respect that, right? Like, this is a lot. Too many recruiters don't want to give the appearance they don't know something, so they BS, and clients can spot that, right? It's, you know, it's so much better to be transparent than to try and BS. And you just get so much more respect, I think, by being, you know, yourself. So I like the philosophy. What does that look like in practice when, like, don't sell in the first call? Can you give a little more, like, insight into that or an example?
Yeah. So I learned early on, look, that, you know, that recruiting was the path to relationship building. And so what I would do, and it's Norm and I, you know, kind of cooked up and what we kind of called our 360 call, was Norm and I, if I could get a position or I could get a search and it was, you know, somewhat senior level, Norm and I would smile because that gave us the opportunity to go call a bunch of really senior people, right? And say, hey, I'd love to network with you about what I'm working on. Let me tell you about the role, tell you about the client. It may or may not be, you know, something for you personally, but would love to, if you're open to it, put our heads together to try to get to the right person if you're in your network, if you're open to it. And so immediately I wasn't asking for, you know, anything other than let me share something with you, which I learned from Scott Love was a deposit, right? People, mm-hmm. people in the industry like to hear about what else is going on, what companies are hiring. Right. And so we'd go through that discussion. I'd tell them about what I'm working on. And then I immediately afterwards would pivot to how about your career? What's going on in your career? Are you sticking around at this company for the gold watch, which again was a, you know, corny, but, or if the right thing came along, would you be open to hearing about it? So I'd start with the recruiting on something I was working on. I'd quickly pivot to their own career. And if they said, look, yeah, no, actually, I'd love to learn about things. I'd say, okay, I'd go into an interview about, you know, what's your responsibility today? How many people do you manage? Da, da, da. Like what would great look like? And then I'd go put that on a sticky note and I'd be like, hey, call Joe Smith next time you have something like this. Right. And I'd stop. Or if a person would say, hey, actually things are going remarkably well here. I'm kicking butt. I've got, you know, this team. I would say, hey, that's awesome. You know, if you're not open, if you're staying put, you know, what could I do to potentially add value to make sure that you're kind of achieving the best level of success at your current company? And they're like, well, you know, I've got a full team, but, you know, stay in touch. I was like, great. That's awesome. That means that you're a good manager. So people are sticking with you. But is there a particular geography in the country, if you're a sales manager, that's maybe not, you know, is everybody making 100% of their number, or is there somewhere that's a soft spot that I could keep an eye open for? Right. And so the whole MPC concept of, yeah, you know what, if you know somebody in the Southeast that does this, this, and this, you know, let me know. I was like, great. I appreciate it very much. And I'd let him go. And I would basically establish the fact that that person would take my call at a later date if I had a candidate in the Southeast that could top grade with. And so how many times I could go through and accumulate that. And then I would go back and I'd look for those folks and I'd interview, you know, and I would try to proactively MPC. And again, you know, I think that the key for newer folks in the business is like, no company's going to, you're not going to call anybody up 10 minutes into the industry and somebody's going to hand you the best search on the planet, right? You're going to have to get a lot of C's and B's and MPCs and turn it, you know, turn those into activity that yields something. And so, and the key was, you know, I would follow up, right? Like I didn't just take that and toss it out as a wasted opportunity. I took that and a month later, that company was going to hear from me and say, hey, you remember when we talked a month ago? Well, I wrote that down and I came across somebody I thought you should know about. And they're like, wow, you actually wrote that down. How about that? Yeah, tell me about them. Right. And so, you know, doing that over and over and over again early on was really how I got started. And you know, frankly, in what's a little bit of a shaky market right now, you know, I let the candidate, if I could come up with a candidate, I let that speak for themselves. Yep. Because I also learned early on that if I got stuck in a dance around, tell me about your process, tell me about your references. I was like, well, I didn't have any, and my process is just, you know, the same as everybody else's, if not worse, right? And so, but if I could find you a great candidate, I'll let the candidate speak for themselves. And so that was really kind of the approach I took, because I learned, again, you know, I can't hide the fact I'm 23 and I have a year of experience doing this, right? And so, but what I can do is I can bring you a great candidate and get you talking, and you know, that's the work product versus, you know, having you to just have to bet on me.
It's interesting. I had Chris Shuttlecote on the podcast a while back, and we ran out of time. It was such a great conversation, but where we were going and we never resolved is, can young junior, like, folks out of college or years experience, do they have the credibility to win senior level searches? And my argument was yes, and he was skeptical, but you've just given a case study of how that can potentially work. You know, sometimes enthusiasm, hustle, you know, and honesty goes a long way. And ultimately it's down to, can you produce, can you come up with a candidate? And if you have the right talent, then that speaks for itself. Your references are secondary then to, here's the candidate that you want, right? And they're represented by me. Could you mentioned like post-it notes, and you had all this bits of market intelligence, insight into different companies, different hiring managers, what their kind of hiring needs potentially were going to be. How, now at the time you're using post-it notes, but how do you guys keep track of all those leads and follow-up calls now? Like, what's the system?
It hasn't improved a whole lot. So, okay. Yeah, so we, you know, we use PCR today, yeah. And shamelessly, I was trained on WinSearch. We probably switched to PCR 5 years into my career, and in the same way Norm's go, I'm go. Like, I couldn't get my head around trying to switch systems and take away from what I was doing. So I surrounded myself with a team that learned how to do it. So I still, you know, I use Outlook. I put follow-ups on my calendar. I write everything down. I went paperless during COVID, so I got an iPad and an Apple Pencil that I keep notes on, that's very searchable. Don't tell Jordan, our finance lead, who was our IT guy earlier in his career, because it drove him nuts. But and then actually we have a Crelate account these days, that just for the CRM. And so I have a gentleman in my ops manager who helps with scheduling and is copied on all my emails. So he grabs stuff and puts it in Crelate and then sends me a report of all the leads.
All right, listen, stop, because this sounds like a disaster. Yeah,
it's a disaster, Mark. This is not to be replicated by anybody. Okay. And I try to not tell anybody. That's how I do it.
Okay. All right. No problem. So this is the funny thing though, like, and I'm glad you told that story, because nobody is perfect. Nobody has absolutely everybody has things that they're excellent at and things that they're, you know, less strong at. And the key is strength and strengths. Focus on those things that you do excel at and focus, you know, spend as much time on that stuff as possible rather than trying to be, have no flaws. Just instead, hire the people in your team who can complement what you're good at and make up for those deficiencies, right?
One of the biggest lessons in business, in my opinion. I was fortunate. I hired a gal, Casey Kaiser, who's been a partner at DRI for a long time. And, you know, if recruiting is a combination of art and science, I'm the artist and she's the scientist. Okay. And so we've worked really, really well together for a decade plus, and she can interpret my mishigas, or what my team calls mic speak, and she can disseminate that, you know, in the appropriate process driven way to help our team do what they need to do. But I learned early on that if I was going to try to figure everything out in the CRM and do all that, like, it just wasn't my strength. It would suck the life out of me. But you put me on the phone with anybody and I feel comfortable. So surround yourself with people that complement your skills and cover up your weaknesses.
100%. And this is why I think sometimes I meet a lot of solo practitioners and they're like, no, I'm never going to hire. I don't want to manage people. you know, I'm just like doing my own thing. And that's okay. Like there's, I guess if that's truly what you want, then great, go for it. But on the other hand, is it more fear or, you know, limiting mindset that's preventing you from building a team, which could, you just can't imagine how much better it could be if you did what you're great at and you have other people who are all rowing together. Like you're in a boat rowing by yourself. You can only go so fast and so far, right? But if you have a whole crew who are rowing in the same direction, man, you can really motor. It's like a whole nother ball game. I definitely couldn't. I realized it late in my career, but I eventually realized that I was dramatically underperforming on my potential because I was trying to do everything myself.
It's Mark. It's the conversation that my good buddy Rich Rosen and I have been having for years. You know, but Rich is a monster solo producer, and he's hired a few people over the years, and Rich is just so ADD because he's got so much energy that he, like, people can't keep up with him. And he's made an amazing career out of it. In talking to clients and seeing how companies were built and being, you know, participating in building companies, I took note of how the infrastructure of companies, you know, successful companies were complementary skill sets, and you need blockers and tacklers. You don't need all A players, and you need folks that have a complementary set of skills that, you know, the five dysfunctions of a team was for, you know, my partner Dan had made all of us read, and it was a great book. I love developing business. I love closing deals. I love managing clients. I really never love recruiting.
Yeah.
My talent, I think where I'm strongest and where I get my energy from is in being in front of customers and trying to grow the business. And if I could be really good at that, I can hire people to help fulfill the searches.
Yeah.
And that was just a natural kind of thing for me because I wasn't, when I was grinding through and having to recruit all day, those to me were frustrating days because I didn't feel like I was working at top of license, right? And so, you know, if I could be a world-class business developer, I needed to go find people that could be world-class recruiters and really love that because recruiting is far more process-oriented, in my opinion, than business development. Yeah. And I learned that. So surrounding myself with Norms and Casey's and a whole bunch of others since then has been just was an aha moment for me early in my career.
Amazing. Yeah, 100% agree. Well, let's just segue into that then, the building of a team, because you've now, how many people are in your practice now, Mike?
I personally have about 20.
Okay.
And Norm's group kind of spun off our group. So all in our practice is about 27, 28.
Amazing. So what are the key... Well, let's start with, like, what are some of the mistakes that you made in trying to grow a team, and what did you learn from them?
Early in my career, you know, when I was in my early 20s and trying to hire folks, I felt comfortable hiring folks that were younger than me.
Mm-hmm.
I had a tough time thinking that I could hire somebody that had 10 years more experience than me and that they would listen to me. And maybe that was, I got over that,
yeah.
And I think, you know, you spend so much time at work, that I was really, you know, want to be buddies in addition to working. So I was always trying to walk that fine line. And so, you know, when I hired Norm, I was probably 25, he was probably 21. Right. And there was a few other guys that came work for me at the same time who were great guys, and maybe they helped me kind of figure out what I needed to do next. There was kind of different eras, I think one of the things I learned is you can't teach motivation.
Yeah.
Like, people have to be self-motivated. You can teach them skill. You can't, but you can't teach them motivation. I also think,
Mike,
and
hold
it's,
on.
It's a little...
hold that thought. Don't forget what you're about to say. I want people to really get that. Like, let it sink in, because so often we see people and they are leaning towards hiring someone who is experienced rather than this person who has the drive and the self-motivation. You still with me, Mike?
Yep. I'm here, yep. Mark. Sorry, there's a lawnmower outside my window. I wanted to
all right,
close that.
No problem. So, yeah, like, hire for mindset and attitude and train for skill all day long. You know, it's just so much easier to manage people who are self-motivated. You don't have to, because you can't make people do stuff, right? That's just never...
You can't.
It's never going to scale, and it's just going to suck up all your time and end in frustration. You need to hire people who have that drive, and they are motivated, they're smart, and they will drive your business forward for you.
100%. I think one of the other things that's really important, that's it's very hard to do, especially as you're early team building, I would wait to start looking for people when I needed to make a hire, right? And so I would end up hiring what was in front of me and what was available.
Yes.
And I think made a lot of, you know, hired a lot of good people, but that were not necessarily the best for what I was looking for. And mm-hmm. so I really make a point of, you know, and it's only been in the last few years, but try to consistently interview, consistently
exactly.
have a pipeline of people coming through. And even business was a little, you know, has been a little slower, you know, this past spring. I hired 3 new people because 3 really great people jumped into my lap that I didn't have the work for them, but I couldn't let them go.
Yes.
That was something that I've, you know, I would encourage everybody. Like, I've even the most average recruiter I've ever hired, I made money on, right? You won't lose money on them. If they're at least a decent person, you won't lose money on them. So get over that fear, I think. But if you can make be proactive as far as finding talent,
yes.
it'll pay dividends.
I'm so glad you said that. Like, we have a whole class on recruiting recruiters for our clients, and always be interviewing. You have to just, as you say, build a pipeline of talent. Even when you don't have an opening or you're not quite ready to hire or whatever, be interviewing constantly, you know, because then, you know, the funny thing is, like, you need to treat your own internal hiring with the same weight or commitment that you do when you're serving clients, right? But firm owners don't think that way. They prioritize the search, which has a invoice attached to it, you know, which is a direct invoice, and they don't have as much emphasis or commitment to unearthing that great talent for their own business, which is crazy. It should really be the other way around.
It should be the other way around. And I learned early on, you know, my partner Dan Charney would tell me, you know, forget whatever deal you're working on. You hire a great recruiter, it'll, you know, that person could be worth $1 million.
Exactly. To your practice. Exactly. Well, speaking right. of that, you have hired, mentored, and developed multiple million-dollar billers. Could you, like, that's unusual. That's very, very unusual. You know, it's rare to have $1 million biller in a practice. How have you fostered that at DRI?
I think it's really been on the focus of, I'm super top of funnel driven as far as how I look at my week in business. And if you can bring in job orders, you can build a business mm-hmm. in recruiting, right? I think the folks that try to balance, and I have a lot of good friends in Pinnacle that try to balance it where they're, you know, spending half their week recruiting yep. and then they start doing business development out of necessity because yep. their searches are coming to an end. And to me, that's just a really tough position. I spend my whole week doing top of funnel development activities. Yeah. And you can hire along the way to fulfill those. Mm-hmm. And so the emphasis on new clients and new job orders all the time. I mean, look, I work in the software space. I've probably had on 10 to 15 different occasions, I've had my best client or biggest billing client be acquired and disappear.
Of course.
Over the years. Yes. Right. And so, I've had to learn the hard way that you can't be reliant on any one customer or any one relationship. Yep. I'm obsessed with top of funnel, and I think the folks that have done really well and that have really grown on my team, and there's plenty of folks that have done really well that aren't business developers, but the folks that I think the key to being a perpetual seven-figure biller or whatever the case may be is new customer, current customers, but always be looking for new customers.
Yeah.
And new relationships, and like never rest on your laurels, because it's just that's how you get into kind of a cyclical, you know, slump, good month, slump, yeah, good month. The way to have consistent good month over good and good month and good year over good year is always have new business coming in the door.
Absolutely. Well said. And, yeah, so interesting. But at the same time, that requires, the reason people do this feast famine thing is when they're trying to do everything themselves again, right? We're coming back to that, because they're almost like, well, I don't want to get too busy because I won't be able to fulfill the searches I already got. So they're always just trying to, they're doing just enough BD to top up what either they fill or falls off. But it's almost impossible to get that balance right. So usually you're under, you know, emphasizing BD, and usually there's always going to be some kind of down month or down quarter when you're trying to do it that way. So
the other thing, Mark, people put BD on a pedestal.
Okay.
I think Norm would tell you the same thing. Like BD is, you know, marketing is not this like, you know, elusive, crazy thing. It's just talking to people and asking a few extra questions, right? And you're never, you know, it's super, super rare. I learned early on, like, that you're going to call some CEO and he or she's going to be like, yeah, I need a VP of marketing. We've never talked before, but let me give you this great search, right? No, it's just like having those relationship building, deposit in the bank account conversations, just having them, enough of them, leaving a good impression. And that person will call you at a later date, right? If you make the right impression. I find so much that recruiters fall into recruiting out of comfort and because they're nervous to step out of that.
True.
And I think like that's what, you know, that's just a challenging pattern to get into. And I've never met most folks would tell you if they've had a customer for a decade and a lot of their business comes from that customer and they don't market that customer, they're going to beat you up on fee every time a new HR person comes in. Yeah. They're going to, you know, the relationship never gets better over time, right? You end up just having a higher pain tolerance. And so by having a good flow of top funnel stuff, like, you can avoid getting in the death spiral of diminishing returns with a long-term customer too.
Absolutely. Oh yeah. I mean, I'm sure everybody listening could think of a story or an example where your best customer, as you said, like, they could get acquired. Your main sponsor in that company could change jobs. And then like a new person comes in and they want their person who they already have a relationship with, another firm or whatever. There's so many things that can happen. It's so vulnerable to be over dependent on a small number of customers. So, Mike, in summary, you're saying that the key to being a top producer is constant top of funnel activity. Like, is that what it boils down to?
It's very much. I mean, look, it's the same thing that works in any client company you have. I mean, to grow, in order to have, you know, recruiting to do, or in client cases, customer success activities and implementation activities, you need to sell, right? And so I think the more at-bats you're getting, the more opportunities coming through your team, you know, and the more quality opportunities you have coming through your team, the more everything else kind of falls into place. And frankly, when you have deal flow and cash flow, as my partner Dan would say, it allows you to, you get more confident. You call higher, you ask for bigger fees, you ask for exclusivity, you ask for things that when you don't have much going on, you're just like, yeah, I'll take what I can get. But when you've got the confidence of having a really full desk, you know, first of all, your time is much more valuable. You're less interested in putting up with BS, and you're more comfortable asking for the things you need that you know you need to be successful and to get the deals done. And so top of funnel, you know, full top of funnel will just really, you know, it makes everything smoother. It makes you more confident, and it's going to lead to more money.
That is the perfect way to finish up our call, Mike. I think that's really, really well said. I know you've got another meeting you need to go on to. Really enjoyed that. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Mark, I'm really grateful. I was trolling you in San Diego a bit, hoping you were going to ask me to come on, because I was jealous that half all my other Pinnacle buddies were already on the Mark Whitby podcast. I was like, yo, Mark, let's say, hey, I'm Mike, nice to meet you. So thank you for very, very much for inviting me on. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have an awesome day and look forward to speaking again soon.
You too, brother. Thank you much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button, and I'll see you next time.